I'd like to call House Special Committee on Fisheries meeting to order. Today is Thursday, March 16th, and let the record reflect it is 10 a.m. Today we have President Representative McCormick and myself, Chair Vance. I would like to remind committee members and those in the audience to please silence your cell phones. The staff assisting us today is Justin Hayes with House Records and Lisa Denny from the Juneau LAO. Thank you for your work. On today's agenda, the committee will hear a presentation on the Salmon Ocean Ecology Program, otherwise referred to as SOAP, by the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. And I will say you'll have the coolest stickers, and I want more of them, please. We will now hear a presentation on the Salmon Ocean Ecology Program by the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. And here to give the presentation via Microsoft Teams is Dr. Katie Howard. And the ADF&G liaison, Joe Fuckel, will be moving the slides here in the room. Dr. Howard, thank you so much for coming before us today. If you could please place your name on the record. I would like to let the record reflect we've been joined by Representative Henshute and Representative McCabe. Dr. Howard, I imagine that we will have questions along the way. So after you do a few slides, if you could just take a pause to see if there are questions. It tends to be more interactive, and we learn a lot that way. So please state your name for the record and begin your presentation.
Okay, good morning. For the record, my name is Dr. Katie Howard, and as mentioned, I lead the Salmon Ocean Ecology Program at Alaska Department of Fish and Game. And this presentation is just going to give a really high-level overview of about the Salmon Ocean Ecology Program, or SOAP for short, and we'll share some of the important marine salmon research topics that we are currently tackling to provide more information for Alaska salmon fisheries management. So this program was initiated about 3 years ago. The Salmon Ocean Ecology Program at ADF&G currently consists of three staff, whose primary duties are focused specifically on marine salmon research. So this includes myself as lead, and I primarily deal with statewide, international, and federal fisheries issues. Because we have a small team with some big responsibilities, it's also a function of my position to build out collaborations with other entities so that we can maximize our impact with the person power that we have. Sabrina Garcia is a biologist housed in the AYK region, and her position duties align really closely with the SOAP activities, so we consider her a part of our core team. She leads and is first point of contact for marine salmon issues related to AYK origin stocks. And then finally, we have Ben Gray, who was hired about a year ago into a newly created Fishery Biologist 2 position. And he assists us with a research project implementation. The goals of SOAP are to understand the marine life of Alaskan salmon, to use this information to assist with fishery management decision making. And we also help to answer pressing questions about what drives Alaskan salmon abundance and survival at sea. For salmon, Alaska has invested heavily in a wide array of coastal and freshwater monitoring projects throughout the state, primarily for returning adults, such as test fisheries, weirs, counting towers, sonars, and aerial surveys, as well as other methods like mark recapture techniques to assess salmon abundance and demographic characteristics to aid sustainable salmon fisheries management. Comparable marine monitoring assessments have historically been lacking for most of Alaska and really most of North America, though there have been some pretty extensive marine salmon assessments that have been established over a much longer time period in Asian countries. While many different research methods are used to study various aspects of the marine life of salmon, the international gold standard for effective long-term monitoring includes research surveys focused on the first summer at sea, so what we call the juvenile life stage. So this is targeted in part because salmon stocks tend to be concentrated and easier to assess at this life stage compared to later immature life stages. But more importantly, this life stage is considered to be really critical for survival, And studies at this life stage have been found to have a lot of advantages for understanding factors that drive salmon populations. These surveys typically use research trawls, which are much smaller than commercial fishing trawls, and they're modified to fish at the surface of the water column. So we're fishing the top 15 meters or about 45 feet of the water column. And that top 45 feet of the water column is prime juvenile salmon habitat. In addition to location and abundance information, these surveys typically collect genetic information so that we can assess which stocks of salmon we are encountering. We look at indicators of the health of the salmon and other important features of their habitat, such as food resources, water temperatures, and other stocks and species sharing these habitats that may have competitive or predatory interactions with our salmon stocks. Now, we have two established juvenile salmon survey programs. There's the Southeast Alaska Coastal Monitoring Project, or SECM for short, and this assesses northern Southeast Alaskan juvenile salmon as they migrate out of inside waters and into the Gulf of Alaska. And this project was initiated by NOAA about 26 years ago. And more recently, ADF&G has become a partner co-leading that project. Southeast region ADF&G staff are the primary leads on this project, and the SOAP program provides whatever support we can to those region staff to support this effort. The other really well-established project that we have is in the Northern Bering Sea, which was, again, initiated by NOAA about 20 years ago, and it has become a collaborative project over the past dozen years or so with ADF&G as a partner. Sabrina Garcia from our program is the ADF&G lead on that project, and that project has been really integral to not only forecasting Yukon River Chinook salmon, but also helping us triangulate which life stages in Yukon River Chinook are the most susceptible and most critical for driving population abundance. We've also been using data from this survey to develop forecasting tools for Norton Sound and Yukon River pink salmon. And we're building out forecasts and analyses for chum and coho salmon in the region as well. Thanks to some CIP funding, we are building out a survey in the Southern Bering Sea. We've done some feasibility assessment in this region, and the hope is to kick off a more permanent assessment that will enable us to forecast Kuskokwim and Nishigak Chinook salmon, Western Alaska chum salmon, and Bristol Bay and Kuskokwim sockeye salmon. That CIP funding is also enabling the initiation of a new Western Gulf of Alaska survey, which is expected to capture salmon of all species from Cook Inlet, from some Kodiak, and particularly Chinook stocks. Our hope is that if we can maintain these surveys over a number of years, it will provide the same kinds of insights and management tools for those important Alaskan salmon stocks that we've been able to develop for some of these other established surveys. Now, over the next few slides, I'll summarize some of the ways that these monitoring projects, combined with some of our other shorter-term research projects, are contributing to answering some pressing questions Alaskans have about the marine life of salmon. And I'm wondering if maybe this is a good time to pause and see if there's any questions before I move on to those other questions.
Any questions from committee members? Okay, seeing none, please continue.
Okay. So one of the questions we often encounter in salmon fisheries is how can we better anticipate future salmon run abundance? Managers and stakeholders can only respond to whatever runs actually show up in a given year, and often we don't have a good idea of what that magnitude of abundance will be until well into the fishing season, depending on the kinds of in-season assessment projects that are available in a given region. This sometimes gives little to no time to adjust actions and respond swiftly, particularly when returning abundance differs quite a bit from what we've seen in recent years' abundance. Typically with salmon forecasting, where we only have adult abundance data to go off of and estimate what future run abundance is expected to be, we're usually pretty lucky if we can develop reliable forecasts at all. And often we're only anticipating what's likely to come in the next season. However, when we can leverage the marine juvenile abundance data, we can often develop reliable forecasts and forecasts that can give a further heads up of what to expect in the future. So for example, for chum and Chinook salmon, which spend another 3 to 4 years in the ocean after we assess them as juveniles, we can develop forecasts that look ahead up to 3 years into the future. And so that provides a little more time for planning and for adjusting to those expectations. So on this slide, these figures are demonstrating our ability to anticipate future adult run abundance based on juvenile abundance. And both of these figures are illustrating how well actual Southeast Alaska pink salmon commercial harvests align with those predicted using juvenile salmon data from the SECM survey in Southeast. And these figures are simply showing this performance in slightly different ways. On the left-hand figure, if the forecasts all perfectly predicted what actually returned, all those dots would fall perfectly on that dotted black line. On the right-hand figure, this displays how that performance tracks over time. So it's just a different way of showing the same data. The actual pink salmon harvest that occurs are the gray bars on the right-hand figure, and the preseason predicted harvest from the juvenile abundance data is the solid black line. Now, while there are a few years that stand out where the forecast didn't perform as well, overall, the forecast has been quite effective at accurately forecasting future commercial harvests, and this forecast has become increasingly important for managing these fisheries. Similar forecasting tools are under development for other Southeast Alaska salmon species using the data that are collected in the SECM survey. For species like Chinook salmon, that tend to spend more time in the ocean before returning as adults, we do have that distinct advantage of juvenile-based forecasting tools providing a further heads up on what to expect in the future. And as I mentioned, for Chinook, that can be up to 3 years into the future. And a good example of where we've been able to do this is for Yukon River Chinook salmon, based on the juvenile abundance data that we get from the Northern Bering Sea Survey. So the figure on the left here shows how well aligned the juvenile abundance is to the total adult returns of Yukon River Chinook in future years. And the figure on the right shows how well that forecast has performed in each run year. The gray bars are the actual run abundance that occurred in each year, and the black brackets indicate the preseason forecast that occurred in each of those years. Typically with this tool, again, as I mentioned, we've been able to forecast up to 3 years in the future. You're not seeing a 3 years heads up on this particular figure, and that's because a survey didn't occur in 2020 because of COVID concerns, and there were restrictions at NOAA to limit their surveys at that time. So the unfortunate thing is that one missing year, juvenile year, results in 2 to 3 years where we're unable to forecast adult run abundance. And this is particularly unfortunate because right now the runs are so poor, and having that expectation would be really important for planning ahead. Now, you might also notice on this figure on the right in particular, the forecast performed really well right up until 2022, when it failed to identify the poorest run ever recorded. And we believe the poor forecast performance in 2022 had to do with marine heat wave conditions in the Eastern Bering Sea during the years when those fish were juveniles. And in those years, conditions were really unprecedented, and nobody really anticipated just how much those marine heat wave conditions would affect juvenile salmon survival. And we have a much better understanding of that now. And I'll talk a little bit more about that later in this talk. Now, sticking with Yukon River Chinook salmon, another important question we often hear is, what is driving record poor runs of Yukon River Chinook salmon? And as I'm sure you're aware, the Yukon is facing some really devastating salmon declines. And this has led to closures to commercial, sport, and even subsistence fisheries. For Chinook salmon, this decline has been ongoing for over a decade, and 2022 saw the poorest run ever recorded. We're starting to get a clearer picture of what might be causing the decline, thanks to a series of separate investigations focused on various aspects of Yukon Chinook salmon biology and ecology. And this list of reports is many of those investigations. Combining this information with the juvenile abundance estimates, which is a really critical piece in the puzzle, we think what may be going on with Yukon River Chinook salmon has to do with what we call multiple metabolic stressors acting on adult Chinook salmon, returning adult Chinook salmon. And it helps to think of salmon like a battery when we're talking about metabolic stressors. When salmon are out in the ocean, they are feeding and growing, and they're charging up that battery before their spawning journey. When they enter the river, they switch to drawing down that battery. And when we think of Yukon Chinook, and particularly those fish that spawn in Canada, they have the longest spawning migration of any Pacific salmon. They're really doing the equivalent of running an ultra marathon every day for about a month, and they're doing it without really eating. And if that's not bad enough, the females then have to have extra energy and extra nutrients to pack into their eggs so that their eggs have a good chance of survival. It's really a tremendous amount of work that needs to happen, and all of that preparation to be able to do that is occurring out in the ocean. And so when we're talking about metabolic stressors, it's all of the things that are disrupting the Chinook's ability to either fully charge their battery out in the ocean, or it's causing them to draw down their battery far too quickly. Now, for Yukon Chinook, we have some indication that both may be happening. We think that in recent years, we're seeing metabolic stressors occurring in Yukon Chinook salmon from disruptions to the quality of food that these returning salmon moms are receiving in the ocean. We're seeing disease like ichthyophonus that these fish are acquiring in the ocean, and that disease, having a disease, it causes a tremendous amount of metabolic stress. And then we're seeing heat stress in some of the recent years that is also causing these fish to draw down their batteries far too quickly. All of that combined with these particularly long spawning migrations are probably acting concurrently on Yukon River Chinook salmon in ways that are causing them to be metabolically stressed. And this may result in reduced reproductive success of the fish. And that means that either the salmon moms may not be surviving their spawning journey, and we do have some evidence that there's probably some en route, what we call en route mortality. They're getting to the river, but they don't make it all the way up to the spawning grounds, particularly the ones going all the way up to Canada. We may also be seeing what we call pre-spawn mortality, and that's they make it to the spawning grounds, but they run out of juice before they can actually spawn, so they're dying with their eggs still in their bodies. Or another thing that we have some evidence for is that some of these salmon moms may be laying eggs that don't have enough energy, don't have enough nutrients for their offspring to be successful. And so all of those things combined are really a function that of them either not fully charging their batteries in the ocean, or them drawing down their battery far too quickly, or both. It's you know, there's some indication that both may be occurring at the same time. Now, we were recently awarded a grant from the North Pacific Research Board to further investigate this concept alongside our partners at USGS, NOAA, and Yukon River Drainage Fisheries Association, or YRFDA. And that work will be starting this summer and continuing over the next 3 years. Oh, along with the Chinook, we also get a lot of questions about what's driving record poor runs of chum salmon to Western Alaska rivers. Concerns of AYK chum salmon has really escalated in recent years since we've seen these dramatic declines in abundance starting in 2020. And, you know, we've seen it through 2022. And as an example of that decline, this figure is showing Yukon River chum salmon abundance. So this is summer and fall runs combined. And while chum salmon runs have historically been variable, the recent patterns have been totally unprecedented. These poor runs have caused tremendous hardship for subsistence harvesters in the region, particularly since Chinook and Coho runs have also been poor, and chum salmon is particularly important as a subsistence food in the region.
Dr. Howard, we have a question from Representative Yes. Carpenter, but before that, I'd like to note that he did arrive at 10:07 a.m., and Representative Johnson did as well. So, Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, when you say unprecedented decline, I would like you to speak to the decline that happened 20 years ago on your graph, in your chart there. There's a decline that ended sometime around 2001, so that's about 20 years ago. It doesn't look like it's too far off or much different than the decline that we see here. It looks like it wasn't as far of a decline, but I see that there's 20 years ago we had a decline. Do we have any understanding of what happened then and what brought the fish back for the next 20 years?
Through the chair, that's a great observation. So we did see a really big decline in chum salmon abundance throughout Western Alaska in about 20 years ago. The runs didn't get as low. They weren't, at the time they were a record low, that the recent runs are a new record low. But it was pretty devastating, for people at the time. The prevailing hypothesis about what seems to have occurred at that time was that there was a warm water related big coccolithophore bloom in the eastern Bering Sea, right where those juvenile salmon spend their rearing time. And that was believed to be related to a really poor survival of chum salmon. However, at that time, we didn't have any of these marine surveys. So we didn't have any eyes on the ground to see what exactly was going on. That is an assumption that the coccolithophore bloom was responsible, but nobody really knows for sure because nobody was out there doing any research and collecting those data.
Follow up.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Can you please define what a coccolithophore bloom is, please?
Yeah, so there are these organisms called coccolithophores that can grow. It tends to be when there's some kind of imbalance, like either it's particularly warm or nutrient related, and they have these hard shells, these that make them not good food, but also it blocks the light a little bit. And so it makes it the visibility in the ocean very poor. And so that was a part of this hypothesis, is that maybe fish couldn't find the food because the coccolithophores were clouding the water too much. But again, nobody was actually out there, so we're not really sure. We just know that it was a period of time that probably affected, one or two juvenile years, and that ended up translating to a couple of run years, but then it quickly resolved itself.
Follow up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What's the relationship between the higher water temperatures and a phytoplankton bloom? If a higher water temperature was a positive factor in coccolithophores development, does a warmer water adversely or positively impact phytoplankton blooms as well?
That's a really complex question, actually, because the Bering Sea is pretty unique. It is really a sea ice driven ecosystem. It's different than the Gulf of Alaska. And so when we're talking about the Bering Sea, the sea ice associated algae is a really important driver for the ecosystem each year. So when there's a lot of good sea ice and that ice recedes, we end up having these really nutritious algae that feeds really nutritious zooplankton, which is the food for our salmon. When we don't have sea ice, like we've had for a couple of these years when there were marine heat waves, we don't get that ice associated algae. You get other kinds of algae that are less nutritious, and there might be abundant, but they're less nutritious. What that has been found is they're less nutritious and they end up feeding less nutritious zooplankton. And that kind of follows all along the food chain. So, that is the situation in the Bering Sea, and it's a different story in the Gulf of Alaska because it's not as dominated by the ecosystem isn't being driven by sea ice the way the Bering Sea is.
Follow up.
What is it about the sea ice that sets conditions for phytoplankton bloom? Is it the temperature or is it what's in the ice?
Partly it's what's in the ice, but it's also the growing season in the Bering Sea is much shorter because you have sea ice coverage over the winter. And then as it recedes, the ice associated, this particular species of algae that are associated with the ice, then kind of have this bloom. And that really kicks off a whole cascade of things that happen in terms of the animals that eat the algae and then the animals that eat the animals that eat the algae. And so the timing of that is really affected by how much sea ice and therefore how quickly that ice retreats and the timing of when that ice retreats. And if that timing is lined up really well with when all of the animals that depend on that algae, the timing of their life cycle lines up. That is also important.
Follow up, because I don't think that answered my question specifically. What I'm wanting to know is there a particular nutrient or mineral or substance in the ice that when it melts, the algae are then able to consume it? What is it about the ice melt that causes a bloom? That's what I'm trying to answer.
Through the chair, there's certainly minerals and chemicals in that are trapped in the ice that get released when the ice melts, and that helps to support the bloom of the algae. But I think part of the issue that is that's really specific to the Bering Sea is that there are certain species of algae that are only associated with the sea ice. And those species, for whatever reason, tend to have a lot of lipids. They tend to be pretty nutrient rich compared to the other species that are available in the Bering Sea that are not ice associated. Am I still not answering your question? I'm sorry.
I think I got part of what I'm looking for. let's put a hypothetical and say that there isn't enough sea ice out there from 1 year, and we recognize that it's going to have a negative impact, and we wanted to make sure that there could be enough phytoplankton. What would we do artificially to make sure that the phytoplankton bloom would support the amount of fish that we sent to the ocean?
Through the chair, I'm not sure there's anything that we could engineering wise do to replace the sea ice, just because that whole ecosystem has for thousands and thousands of years revolved around the fact that there is sea ice there every winter, and that sea ice recedes and it kicks off this whole process. It is a different situation in other parts of the ocean that haven't, where the ecosystem hasn't evolved under those conditions. And so I think what you would see in the Bering Sea, if we continue to have situations where we don't have sea ice, is that eventually the ecosystem would end up looking a lot more like the Gulf of Alaska than it does the Bering Sea. The processes would change. What species are abundant and grow really well would change.
Follow up.
Is there a study that you can point to that tells us what phytoplankton consume in order to bloom, that is the sustenance for the rest of the food chain? Because I think that's kind of what I'm getting at, is what information do we have that tells us what phytoplankton feed off of that is either coming out of the ice for a particular species in the Bering Sea or for another species of phytoplankton in the Gulf of Alaska? What is it that phytoplankton is feeding off of that causes them to grow and bloom?
Through the chair, yes, there are literature that I could point you towards that are talking about, you know, obviously phytoplankton they're feeding off of sunlight, but they need minerals to be able to have their cell functions function properly. And so I think if that's what you're getting at, that there's literature that I can point you to that speaks to that. And there's some really good stuff on Bering Sea specifically, because there's been quite a lot of work done there on this issue.
Madam Chair, can we please request that information?
Yes, I see Joe scribbling out notes very quickly, so he's on it. Thank you, Dr. Howard. I don't see any other questions at this moment, so please continue.
Okay, so I think we have talked a little bit about the declines in AYK chum. And again, to make a long story short, the chum salmon that should have come back to the rivers during these very poor run years, those chum were juveniles in 2016 through 2019. And that time period coincides with the worst marine heat wave that's ever been recorded in the Eastern Bering Sea. And the map that you're looking at now shows the temperature conditions that juvenile chum salmon in the years that would have returned in 2020 through 2022 as adults. When those fish were juveniles, the temperatures they faced during their first summer at sea. Now, anything on this map that is red is unusually warm or warmer than the long-term average. And notice that it is red everywhere. In normal years, the ocean would look mostly white on these kinds of maps. And these weren't just warm years. They were so unusually warm that NOAA declared them major marine heat waves in 2016 through 2019 in the Bering Sea. And those heat waves occur when temperatures are exceptionally warm over a period of at least several days. And you may have heard in the news about the blob in the North Pacific Ocean. And that heat wave occurred in 2014 through 2016, and again in 2019. So it overlapped in time with the Bering Sea marine heat wave. And these two marine heat waves occurring at the same time is why this map looks red everywhere. But I also want to point your attention to how dark red the areas are in the very eastern parts, the coastal parts of the Bering Sea. That is the prime juvenile salmon rearing habitat for AYK chum. And these dark areas are 5 degrees warmer than usual. That is a lot. And even among heat wave years, this one was unprecedented in terms of sea surface temperatures and ocean heat content. Now, consider that these juvenile chums, the ones that should have returned in recent years, they were experiencing extraordinary heat wave conditions during their first summer at sea. And then the ones that survived and made their way into the Gulf of Alaska and North Pacific Ocean, where they overwinter, they faced a heat wave there again. So they just couldn't escape it. Now, thanks to our marine surveys, we've observed some really important changes to juvenile chum salmon ecology during these marine heat wave years that may help explain why they had such terrible marine survival.
We have a question from Representative Carpenter.
Thank you. On the previous slide, Dr. Howard, through the chair, the prime rearing ground for the young salmon, they're depicted in the pictures of the yellow circles. Can you tell me how far offshore those rearing grounds are? Are they 10 miles, 25 miles, 100 miles, 200 miles? What are we looking at distance-wise from the shore?
Through the chair, off the top of my head, I think of it in terms of, bottom depth. So this is all along the continental shelf. So it's all area within the continental shelf. That's really where these fish are staying. So it, they can be quite close to shore, but they are certainly within the EEZ, but it's within the continental shelf. I'd have to, in terms of miles, I would have to get out a map and look it up. I don't have that off the top of my head. They are pretty broadly distributed where you see those ovals, that the outer extent of that oval is encompassing where we see juvenile chum salmon. The chum do spread out a bit more. Chum, sockeye, and pink salmon spread out a bit more than the more piscivorous species like coho and chinook.
Madam Chair, I think that answered my question. In regards to the EEZ, I'm trying to understand how far out the salmon go when they're young, whether they are passing out of the EEZ or whether they're staying out in the outer reaches of the EEZ or whether they're in close to shore is what I'm trying to understand.
Yeah, through the chair, we believe that we are really sampling the vast majority of the population when we have our marine surveys. They're encompassing really most of the chum. When we get up to the Bering Strait, where, Russia and Alaska are really quite close, we do encounter some chum salmon that are Russian origin. But it's really just in the Bering Strait where it's very close to where some of their chum salmon rivers are occurring.
Are we attempting to take samples outside of the EEZ?
Through the chair, we are not. That would require some different permissions and some political willpower to do so.
I have so many more questions, but I will let you continue right now, and I think more will come up as we go along. Please continue.
Okay. I am trying to recall where we left off.
Page 15, I believe.
Oh, thank you. So we talked a bit about, based on these marine surveys, we're seeing these changes to both the ecosystem as well as, you know, how it's affecting juvenile chum salmon in these really strong marine heat wave years that are pretty unusual. And so we're working on a report currently with our NOAA colleagues to document some of these observations so they're more publicly available. The juvenile chum salmon were in incredibly poor condition in these years, far worse than we had seen in any other year in the 20 years that the survey's been occurring in the Northern Bering Sea. We also saw more fish with empty stomachs, which to some extent is expected when you see higher temperatures, their metabolisms ramp up. But also we were seeing that the diets were changing in these particularly warm years. Fish shifted from food that was really diverse food and with a lot of high quality food prey items to less diverse prey and more low quality prey items in these marine heat wave years. We saw higher proportions of salmon and non-salmon species moving northward and different stocks moving northward as well. Particularly, because we've had this survey in the Northern Bering Sea, we were seeing things from the Southern Bering Sea, including things like pollock and cod moving north, where they don't typically occur. And there is quite a lot of evidence from these marine heat waves that occurred in the Bering Sea that, and in the North Pacific Ocean, that the recent heat waves were really unprecedented in scale, in the magnitude, and the duration, of the heat waves. And it did affect salmon. Our surveys indicate that there is some time lag between when the Bering Sea started cooling down again and when the ecosystem kind of is starting to get back to normal. But we are hopeful that the cooler water temperatures we're seeing now and the return of winter sea ice in the Bering Sea will lead to improved marine juvenile survival for Western Alaska chum salmon. I think we can go to the next slide. We often receive questions from salmon stakeholders about the roles that predators are playing in the marine survival of our salmon stocks. And there are a few ways that we're addressing this question. While we're at sea on our marine salmon surveys, we occasionally encounter salmon sharks. And we've begun tagging these salmon sharks with satellite transmitting and data archival tags to assess their migration patterns and how these predators overlap in time and space with prey species like Alaskan salmon. The left-hand picture shows one of our tagged sharks, and on the right, this video is showing the movement pattern of that shark over the course of a year. So we can line that up with where we know our salmon are occurring. Additionally, on our marine surveys, we encounter salmon with wounds or scars from predators. I think we can go to the next slide. And we've begun documenting and analyzing this evidence to provide insight into patterns of predation over time. And finally, predator species are generally not well captured in our marine survey gear. In the case of marine mammals, we specifically do not trawl whenever we see a marine mammal present, and that's in accordance with the Marine Mammal Protection Act. So to develop an indication of the presence and absence of various predator species in our survey areas, we've begun working with NOAA's Okpe lab geneticists to explore the use of environmental DNA or eDNA to assess predators. And eDNA is an emerging technology that detects tiny amounts of DNA that animals naturally slough off through skin cells and other sources And we can get that information, that DNA, simply by sampling the water.
Dr. Howard, we have another question from Representative Carpenter.
Dr. Howard, the salmon shark example that you were using, are we finding that the salmon shark are actually finding salmon? Like, is there evidence that they're eating salmon?
Through the chair, there are really limited studies on what salmon sharks are actually eating. They appear to be what we'd call generalist predators. So they're not necessarily keying in on salmon, except in those locations where they might, and times when they might have a concentration of salmon. So like when fish are returning as adults, if there's a really high abundance, say in Prince William Sound, of salmon returning and there are salmon sharks there, then they'll really focus on, they appear to really focus on feeding on salmon because they're very abundant at that time. But in other locations and at other times, excuse me, they don't appear to be focused specifically on salmon. So what we don't know, because we don't have the data, is what are they feeding on when they're not near coastal areas and when they're not near fisheries, because that's where all of these analyses of their diet are occurring, is when they're caught in a fishery and you can open them up and look at their stomach contents. So that is a bit of an unknown that we're trying to see, okay, are they even overlapping in space and time with where we know that salmon are occurring, to see if it's, there's the potential there or not.
Follow up.
Madam Chair, Dr. Howard, our survey plan doesn't include surveys outside of the EEZ, but I see the shark swimming around here, at least the dot bouncing around way outside the EEZ. And it's my understanding that that's actually where the salmon are going, but we don't know that because we don't survey it. And I think the slides in your presentation are going to get to some larger surveys going on outside, from entities outside the state of Alaska. But I'm concerned that our focus has been on what's easy for us to access as humans right along the coast to try to understand salmon, and the problem is actually not where we're looking. And so I trust the salmon shark, if salmon shark in the name is actually realistic to what the animal feeds on, salmon, that the salmon shark is much better than humans at finding salmon. So if I've got one tagged and it's out anywhere along its life cycle, it's probably finding salmon, would just be my hunch. So I hope to hear in the presentation what it is that we're doing to get outside of the coastal waters to understand what is happening with salmon.
Dr. Howard, we have a question from Representative Hemshoot.
Thank you, through the chair, Dr. Howard. I also was fascinated by the moving dots. So I want to confirm that's one salmon shark. And then I also wanted to know why the colors of the dots change. What does that indicate?
Through the chair, that is one salmon shark, and it might be that the legend might be a little bit small for you, but those are different months of the year. So that's tracking that salmon shark over the course of an entire year. So you get the visual of the movement, but also the month is the different coloration.
Thank you, through the chair. I hadn't noticed the key. Thank you.
Dr. Howard, do you know of other entities like NOAA who are doing studies further out on the ocean? You know, like, for instance, where it shows that this salmon shark spent a considerable amount of time in the red and the orange. You know, there's this definitely targeted area. Do you know if there's other organizations who are doing studies asking similar questions?
Madam Chair, there are, and we are to the best extent. I'll talk a little bit more about some of this work in a few slides from now, but we are working with those entities as much as possible. So there was this International Year of the Salmon Survey, which brought together scientists from all over the Pacific, from Russia, Japan, Canada, the U.S., to work together to do a really broad, expansive, the biggest of its kind, survey to assess where salmon are, to look at their genetics, look at their health, see what other species are out there where the salmon are. And we use that as an opportunity as well to tag some salmon sharks. So we got some of that information from these surveys. So we were out there as well. The Russian scientists, they have where we have traditionally invested a lot in surveying our river systems and freshwaters and assessing that. They took a very different approach. So for many decades, they have been doing marine surveys. And so they do quite a lot. It's primarily within their EEZ, but they do some broader surveys. The Japanese scientists also do surveys well outside their EEZ. And we've put our staff on board their ships to try to help collect data that benefits us, benefits Alaska salmon, because they're going out in places that we aren't. So I'll talk a little bit more about some of that coming up, but there aren't a lot. There's certainly not a lot in North America that are going out much farther from coastal areas and looking at really the immature life stage, what we call the immature life stage. So after that first year at sea, and what's happening at that life stage beyond these, the International Year of the Salmon Survey and what the Asian countries are doing.
Thank you. It's my hope that the Salmon Task Force that was passed by Congress, sponsored by Senator Sullivan and Senator Murkowski, that this body supported, will find those gaps in the research and help fund more of that, because I think, as Representative Carpenter pointed out, that's clearly what we're lacking. And it feels like we're kind of behind the curve on asking these questions when we're seeing the devastation of our stocks and not having an understanding of what we can do or why it's happening. So we'll look forward to more of the slides where you talk about that. I believe you left off on page 17.
I think if we can move on to the next slide, perhaps. One of the really prominent marine salmon issues that you just brought up that many Alaskans are concerned about is bycatch in non-targeted fisheries, and particularly the federally managed pollock fishery. Now, SOAP plays a role in addressing these issues by providing data, technical support, and scientific advice as appropriate to the National Marine Fisheries Service, the bycatch task force, and to council staff. And this is a supporting role because the fishery issues are outside our jurisdictional purview. But that support is important for ensuring that whatever analyses are conducted are done so with the most appropriate salmon data that the state has. Now, from a research investigation perspective, one of our team members, Sabrina Garcia, is pursuing her PhD at UAF under Dr. Andy Seitz. And her dissertation project is attempting to tag Western Alaska Chinook salmon with data archival tags, which will provide information on the behavior and habitat preference of Chinook during their marine life in the Bering Sea. And the ultimate goal of this project is to combine this behavior and habitat preference data with fishery encounter data and environmental metrics to make predictive maps that are anticipating where Chinook salmon hotspots will be on any given day in the Bering Sea. And the hope is that these predictive maps can be provided to the pollock fishery so that the industry can better anticipate where Chinook salmon will be and avoid those areas, and thereby reducing their bycatch. The council is currently discussing options related to reducing bycatch of Western Alaska chum salmon as well. And we're providing support by working to develop predictive tools using juvenile chum salmon data. And those tools may be useful to the council as they consider their various options. We're doing this work in collaboration with our NOAA colleagues, as well as Dr. Curry Cunningham at UAF. And I'll pause here in case there are questions.
Yes, thank you, Dr. Howard. You've lightly mentioned Russia, and I know that they have a lot of hatcheries. In your opinion, do you think that their hatchery salmon are impacting our Western Alaska fish? And we're talking about just the biomass and the bearing. Do you think that could be, just part of the struggle?
Through the chair. So most of Russia's hatcheries are really producing pink salmon. So those pink salmon, in terms of the Bering Sea, those pink salmon aren't really utilizing the Bering Sea. Their hatcheries are not Bering Sea hatcheries. They're further south. But there are hatcheries, like the Japanese hatcheries are producing primarily chum salmon. Those chum salmon do use the Bering Sea. They also use the Eastern North Pacific as well. Teasing out what impacts these hatchery fish may or may not have is a really big challenge. I think that might be my next slide. It is important. A lot of people are concerned about what those impacts may or may not be. And I will say that because the Russian scientists have this really rich marine survey data, they've been using that to get at these questions of how much food is out there for salmon, how much are salmon consuming, and is there a disconnect there where there's too many salmon for how much food is out there? And what they've been finding, and again, this is for regions where their salmon are concentrated, so in the Western Pacific and in the Western Bering Sea. But what they've been finding for their different regions is that the salmon are consuming between 0 and 15% of the available food. Most of their estimates are 5% or less, but in some locations it's as high as 15%. And their conclusion is that's not a problem. Part of the challenge is that even though we see a lot of salmon, coming back to our rivers, salmon biomass relative to a lot of the other fish out there is not particularly high. It's a pretty small component of all of the pelagic fish species that are out there that are consuming similar food. And so it's really hard to tease apart how big of an impact hatcheries, not just salmon, but hatchery salmon in particular are having on that food source when there's a lot of other players in this food web that that come into play as well. So hopefully that answers your question, and maybe we'll have a little bit more discussion when we get to that slide.
Yes, and I know that Representative Carpenter has been asking specifically these questions about how much does salmon eat and is there enough food out there? And you just stated that the Russians have this information and obviously it's been made available to you. So I guess my bigger question is, is there now an agreement with these different countries for you to share that information as scientists to better understand what's going on in our ocean? Because I think this is specific information that I know Representative Carpenter has been asking, and the Russians have it, and we don't. So I hope that we're asking those now, but able to utilize information that someone else has. Is that something that you can provide to the committee?
Yes, Madam Chair. We can provide references. One of the challenges we do have with some of the Russian studies is that they are published in Russian language scientific journals. And that's not accessible to most North Americans who don't speak Russian. So that is a challenge. So often we will see through the North Pacific Anadromous Fish Commission. That's our main avenue to really connect with some of these other countries and share information, share data. So through that, we get documents that aren't necessarily the full journal article that you would typically see, but is like a 2 or 3 page summary of what research that they're doing. And so that, you know, if that's sufficient, we can provide that as well.
That would be helpful because you are speaking to a representative who has a Russian speaking fisherman in her district who would be able to help with understanding this. So it's not too far off for some of us, but I understand the challenge. You know, this is, I think we're getting ahead asking questions right before you have a slide, but it just shows that we're eager to really know what's going on. So please continue. I think we are on page 19 now.
Okay. This has been a really great segue. Part of the role of our program is to gather information across the scientific literature and from our own research on marine salmon topics that are of concern to many stakeholders and may have important management implications. And one of these is interspecific salmon competition at sea. And our job is to summarize this information in as unbiased and open-minded way as possible and share that with decision makers. So to do this, we try to keep up to date on the scientific literature. And this figure that you're seeing here is an example that's depicting estimated food web interactions in the Gulf of Alaska. And that's from a paper produced in 2012. And salmon are estimated to be a pretty minor player in this analysis. And so it shows up as really small text. And so I had to circle it with red, otherwise you wouldn't be able to see it. We also participate in expert groups of scientists who are attempting to address these concepts. So for example, I've been working on one that's focused on pink salmon across the northern hemisphere. So it includes scientists from all over the Pacific as well as the Atlantic, because pink salmon have been introduced to the Atlantic as well. And they have concerns about what role pink salmon may be playing as this introduced species and how it's affecting their native Atlantic salmon stocks. And we also conduct research that tries to move the conversation and knowledge forward. So one of our current efforts that we're working towards that will help inform the scientific debate on the role of competition is to improve statewide abundance estimates of Alaskan salmon. And this will be done in parallel with similar efforts by other Pacific salmon countries and states under the North Pacific Anadromous Fish Commission. So There has been some pioneering work done by Greg Ruggeroni and Jim Irvine to create Pacific-wide estimates of salmon abundance that are out in the ocean in any year. And most if of the competition analyses that we see that I think Bill talked about on Tuesday, most of those analyses use that data set of those abundances in their analysis. And so our hope is that by improving these estimates of abundance, and by these analyses, that it'll improve those competition analyses as well as other similar analyses. And if these member countries can step up and take on that responsibility to improve the analyses with additional data that, you know, we would have, because it's, you know, our own data, and by making those estimates available on an annual basis, then that should improve all of these competition analyses as well. And then I think on slide 20, okay. Another investigation that we're engaged on to understand competition at sea is a study that leverages data collected on the International Year of the Salmon Survey that I mentioned earlier. So these Pan-Pacific expedition occurred in 2022. There were surveys that were focused on the Eastern Gulf of Alaska that occurred in 2019 and 2020. And that's on this map. There's a light gray shaded area that's in the Eastern Gulf of Alaska. That's where those surveys occurred. The grand survey design that occurred in 2022 are where the white outline boxes are occurring. So that was the biggest of its kind, the most expansive survey of its kind, using multiple vessels from different countries. The department is collaborating on a project that leverages these winter survey samples to assess potential competition between AYK chum salmon and other stocks and species in the winter. And so we'll be analyzing the distribution, the genetics, the diet, and the condition of the fish that we're seeing in winter. And that's will help us evaluate a competition between and among species. And this project includes partners at NOAA and UAF and has been funded by the North Pacific Research Board. And I think these are the slides I have on related to competition. So if there's any more discussion about that this might be a good time to address that.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. What's the time frame for the analysis of those reports that we would have some data available to us in a manner that would help?
Through the chair. So there will be a report coming out this summer that will be providing it, not about competition specifically, but providing an overview of what we saw, what stocks and where they were from the IYS data. So that's happening this summer. And then the analyses, there are a lot of laboratory analyses for the competition piece specifically. Those lab analyses are occurring now. And it will be probably another year or two out before all of that gets summarized into and synthesized into a final report for that particular study, the one I referenced that's related to AYK chum salmon.
Follow up?
No.
Any other questions before? Please continue.
So I believe, are we on slide 21? Okay. So as we've already talked about, most Alaska salmon don't remain in U.S. waters throughout their marine life. So consequently, as we try to tackle some of these really pressing questions and concerns that Alaskans have for our salmon in the ocean, it is critical that we have some international cooperation to make that possible. The International Year of the Salmon effort that I mentioned is an example of that. The capstone project of that effort was the Pan-Pacific Survey that occurred in the winter of 2022. And again, as I mentioned, that we will be having a publication out of that effort coming out very soon. That's going to give a pretty broad overview of really what we saw. But there's more that's going to be coming out because there are different researchers in different countries that are looking at various aspects of the data. They're doing laboratory analyses, looking at everything from diet and condition to things like microplastics and, you know, a whole variety of things that are really specialized. But those data are starting to come out very soon. If we can move to the next one, AEF&G staff do play important roles on the Scientific Committee for the North Pacific Anadromous Fish Commission, or NPAFC. The NPAFC is a primary mechanism for Pacific salmon countries in the U.S., Canada, Japan, South Korea, and Russia to share information and work together towards shared goals of improved understanding of the marine life of Pacific salmon. And AEF&G staff chair working groups that cover genetic assessments, hatchery marking, and stock assessments. And I serve under the Working Group for Stock Assessment. Our working group is developing a new report, which will, for the first time, summarize and synthesize observed patterns and trends of abundance, demographics, and other key features of salmon stocks across the entire Pacific. And this is scheduled to be published this summer as well. And then finally, I referenced this earlier, by developing these relationships with other countries through NPFC, we've been able to leverage resources and opportunities that we just wouldn't have domestically. And so partnerships with researchers in Canada, Japan, and Russia have allowed us to tag salmon sharks aboard their surveys. That's where we're getting some of this data, is we give them tags, and when they're out doing these marine surveys and they catch a salmon shark, then they tag them for us. Sabrina Garcia, one of our team, had the opportunity to go on a Japanese research vessel that was surveying in the Bering Sea, in the central Bering Sea outside of the EEZs. And so those scientists and survey crew helped her tag some Chinook salmon in the Bering Sea that will contribute to our research objectives. And then if we're on 22, I believe.
Yes.
So thank you. So studying salmon in the ocean, as we know, it is not inexpensive. The ocean is a big place, and Alaskan salmon roam far and wide. So we're constantly looking for ways that we can get at some of these questions and some of these concerns with different technologies that could, in the long run, potentially provide less expensive options than these really big marine surveys. One of these is exploring the use of environmental DNA, or eDNA. And I mentioned this previously, but this involves collecting water samples and examining the DNA contained in those water samples to assess the presence of different species. So NOAA's Ok Bay Genetics Lab is pursuing these eDNA techniques, and we're providing support and partnership with these efforts by collecting water samples alongside our trawl samples during our marine surveys. And we hope this will allow us to better develop the technology and see where the limitations and where the possibilities are. We've also got a project where we're using salmon bones, salmon bony structures like vertebrae, like opercula, to recreate the life histories of chum salmon using new technologies. And essentially, these bony structures act like time capsules that record the hormone and chemical concentrations that these fish experience throughout their marine life. And we can use the hormone and chemical concentrations over the fish's life to look at growth, stress, reproduction, et cetera, and see how these various factors might be affected by environmental conditions that these fish are experiencing. On this project, we're providing support to develop this technology by working with Baylor University, who has the technical expertise with this particular technology. Moving on, we recognize that for most Alaskans, the marine life of our salmon is a black box. It is a mystery. Not many people have access or capabilities to observe salmon on the high seas. And not many have access to all of the information that's being generated about the marine environment our salmon live in. So we do recognize that it's particularly important for our program to invest time and energy into communications and outreach so that the information about our salmon at sea is getting back to the people who need it most. We have information on our program associated with the ADF&G website, as you can see here. Most of the page is static. However, we do have a publications tab that we try to keep updated so stakeholders can access reports as they come out. We've also been told by stakeholders that even though there is internet connectivity and bandwidth problems in remote Alaska, Facebook is still a really important way for people in remote villages to access and share information. Consequently, we started up and maintain a Facebook page that shares information about the marine life of salmon and the ecosystems they live in. And the vast majority of our followers are Alaskans, and they reside all over the state. So while our Facebook page, or while our website page is fairly static, the Facebook page provides a more dynamic means of regularly providing new information and interacting with stakeholders. We try to post something new at least 2 times a week, and that QR code will take you to the Facebook page for anyone who's interested. And then outside of the salmon fishing season, we provide many presentations to stakeholder groups, the Board of Fisheries, the Council, and other interested parties. And we tend to average about one presentation every 2 to 3 weeks outside of salmon season. So these are really critical opportunities to not just share information, but also to get feedback and input from our stakeholders. And I think we're at the end of the presentation. So if there are more questions, I'm happy to have further discussion.
Representative Carpenter.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Howard, when you say most Alaska salmon don't remain in Alaska waters, what salmon are you excluding from that list that don't remain in Alaska waters? What remains in Alaska waters?
There are some stocks, or portions of some stocks in Southeast that are believed to stay in inside waters. That is the only thing that comes to mind in terms of Alaskan salmon stocks that tend, there are some group that stays a little more local, but most salmon, they're certainly exiting 3 miles, and most are exiting the EZ, as we've discussed.
I'll follow up on that question then to understand the slide 14 with the circled heat map. Are those circles to represent waters that are, or where salmon would be, that are inside or outside of state waters?
Through the chair, those circles are representing the primary juvenile rearing habitats for Western Alaska salmon. So that is that first summer at sea, and that is, and we kind of target that life stage because we know it's sort of a make it or break it life stage for salmon. If they make it through that time period, that their chances are much better compared to the kinds of mortality we see in later life stages.
I guess a follow-up to that question, then, Madam Chair, would be the later life stages include the fish leaving those prime grounds for deeper water?
Through the chair, that's correct. And part of the evidence that we have that, you know, that early life is really, that early marine life is really critical is because we do have these relationships where, you know, at the end of their first summer at sea, to when these fish return as adults, that the marine survival tends to be pretty stable from year to year. It's, you know, it's still low, you know, that a lot of fish don't make it, but it's pretty stable from year to year. However, the survival from, you know, when the fish are spawned and when we see them at the juvenile stage at the end of their first summer at sea, that is incredibly variable. So most of what's really driving population abundance for the stocks that we have this juvenile abundance information for appears to be happening pretty early in their life. But that's not always the case. We certainly saw that with chum salmon during these marine heat wave years. They were getting hit really hard even after that juvenile life stage.
Follow up? On just on that question, I guess maybe to understand, is it the heat of the water only that's causing an issue, or does the heat of the water also reduce the amount of food supply that's available? I mean, the heat of the water has got to have some impact. I don't know whether it's positive or negative on phytoplankton and zooplankton. So is it the food isn't available in the warmer waters, or is it the warmer waters themselves are just detrimental to cold water salmon?
Through the chair, it's both. It, you know, we certainly see the heat itself is problematic in the sense that fish, they're ectotherms. So when the temperature increases, their metabolisms go up. And so if the food isn't there and their metabolism is ramped up, then, you know, then you have situations where they may be starving. The other issue is that, you know, the temperature is affecting the entire ecosystem. So it may be affecting the food that's available to them. It may be affecting the number and abundance of competitor species that may be around. It may be affecting the number and abundance of predator species that may be around. You know, we are, and that concern really comes up when we're seeing shifts in the distribution of different fish species in these particularly warm years where they're in locations like in the Northern Bering Sea that we don't, where they normally aren't. And so, I would say it's all of the above, but then the other thing we see with increasing temperatures is we do see a tendency for more in some stocks, more susceptibility to disease as well.
One final follow-up.
Follow-up.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is, I'm completely ignorant on this, so I'll just ask the question, for the studies that are being done for ADF&G, who sets the priority for those studies?
Through the chair, a lot of the work that the active research projects that we're doing are funded by grant proposals. And so to some extent, it's dependent on what grant priorities are out there that we can take advantage of. In terms of, you know, how we've set up our priorities for what marine surveys we're going to try to pursue, you know, that is based in part on logistical constraints and what we're able to accomplish, how we can maximize the bang for the buck, as well as, you know, we see it as a longer term goal that, you know, we want to address all of the priority stocks that Alaskans have, particularly the ones where we are seeing disaster declarations, and we are seeing issues where we're not able to prosecute fisheries because there's something going on and these fish are not returning as we would expect.
I'm sorry, that didn't answer my question. So somebody makes a decision to go after a grant for a particular topic. The pronoun we doesn't tell me anything. I'm trying to understand who in the Alaska state government is responsible for identifying the priority or the list of things that we're going to go after with research and what the priority is for spending the money. So who is we and who establishes which topics we're going to study from a given year?
Through the chair, so we, the SOAP team, we take our cues from department leadership and where those priorities are. But a lot of times that is driven by where the funding is. And that could be disaster funding, that could be grant funding. But, you know, ultimately we're following sort of where the priorities are on a statewide level, that we're getting from department leadership.
Thank you very much.
Representative Hemshute.
Thank you, Chair Vance. Through the chair, Dr. Howard, right? you've presented a lot of research here. It's pretty fantastic. Obviously, there's a lot more needed. My question is, I haven't heard anything yet about traditional ecological knowledge or how you're working with the people who know these fish best in the region. So there are the fishermen who know a whole lot, but then there are also the indigenous people of Western and Northern Alaska who know a whole lot as well. What is their role in your research or in the research studies that you've talked about?
Through the chair, I one of the projects I mentioned pretty briefly was an NPRB funded project where we're looking at multiple metabolic stressors on Yukon Chinook. And that project is really intentionally attempting to be inclusive. So we have this Western science arm of the program where we're collecting data that we traditionally collect to get at this question. But we're doing that in in partnership with Yukon River Drainage Fisheries Association, who is helping us connect with local fishermen, have them help collect the data. So citizens are becoming a part of the science. But then there's this other sister project to that one that we're working with YIRDFA on. They're leading the project where they're specifically, working with communities to gather some of this traditional ecological knowledge related to Chinook salmon health that they're seeing when these fish come into the river, the changes they're seeing in the amount of, I've, for example, gotten input from local fishermen that, you know, the belly fat of the Chinook returning to the Yukon River is not what it used to be. They just have less belly fat than they used to have. And so that was a big eye-opening piece of information that has contributed to our knowledge. So we're hoping to get collect some more of that information, present both sides of these two sister projects together. So both pieces of information, sort of the Western side of things and the traditional ecological knowledge side of things are presented at the same time and can hopefully provide a more holistic picture of what may be going on with these fish.
Thank you.
Any further questions from committee members? Well, thank you, Dr. Howard, for this presentation, and look forward to continued reports on your work. I know that you've been tasked with a pretty big ask, but it is something that all of us are waiting to see what we can do to help support these stocks. So thank you once again. That concludes our business for today. The House Special Committee on Fisheries will meet again on Tuesday, March 16th at 10 a.m. Seeing there is no other business for the day, let the record reflect it as we will adjourn at 11:30 a.m.